and Natasha, a very capable tech, were both on hand. Even so, disaster occurred, and Carlos managed to get himself killed by an unarmed native youth. As I read this, is this correct? The machine creature ate him? Not exactly, sir, I said, feeling my sympathy for Carlos rising. Sure, I like to beat on him as much as the next guy, but he was my friend. The machine wanted the metal in his kit. I see. Yes. Then you apprehended the creature and destroyed it. No, sir, I let it go. He eyed me for a moment. An interesting choice. Most troops would have dispatched an alien after it killed their friend. I suppose that's right, sir, but I believe the killing of Carlos to be accidental. Carlos couldn't breathe with his faceplate broken. That's what killed him. And anyway, killing the machine for taking advantage of his death to eat his kit would erase any goodwill we might have developed with our communication attempts. After all, the machine might not understand that breaking a faceplate would result in death. How would it know we couldn't breathe their air? He nodded. A mature response. As to your friends, however, I could see putting Kiwi into tech specialist training. Carlos Ortiz, he's a problem. He's definitely senior enough to warrant training. His fighting skills are adequate, but a tech? The idea is absurd. Agreed, sir, I said. He's not a tech, but I think he's ready for a more advanced assignment of some kind. He's been a regular for a lot of years now. He recently re-enlisted, in fact.
A stroke of good fortune for the Legion, I'm sure. Let me ask you, McGill, where would you place him? If he's not a tech, then should he perhaps be given a larger, more powerful weapon with greater destructive capacity?
Maybe not, sir, I admitted. The idea of Carlos as a weaponeer, it was enough to make a man shudder.
Then perhaps you see him as a leader of men, an inspiration to his cadre of troops, perhaps a replacement for Sargon or yourself in the future.
The look on my face told the story. Drusus read it and nodded.
That's what I thought, he said. A leader must have a clear eye. He must not allow his judgment to be clouded by friendship or sympathy. He must only promote those that deserve it, or the Legion will suffer for his mistakes.
I understand, sir. Maybe Carlos isn't ready.
I have an idea, Drusus said. I'll make a note of it. After this campaign is over, assuming we see Earth again, we'll speak further on the matter.
About that, sir, have we got a chance to win against 60,000 Saurian troops?
Drusus turned his back to the tactical displays.
Probably not, he admitted. But that isn't our only purpose for being here. We're to mark a legitimate claim on this world. If Earth is to expand, to become a three-star civilization, we need this planet. It has all the resources that we lack, which is precisely why the Saurians are here. They see this world as a threat to their monopoly on heavy metals.
I examined the maps alongside him. The data displayed there was both intriguing and alarming. There were indeed 7 Imperial ships parked in orbit, and numerous red blocks representing troop formations all over the mountain. In the center was a single, large blue block, Legion Varus.
They'll have to wipe us out soon, I said. They can't wait around.
Agreed, Drusus said, but I'd like to hear your reasoning.
Well, sir, first off, there's the matter of those 7 Imperial ships parked in orbit. They don't come cheap. Every day they're out here in the field represents a lot of credits for the Saurians.
Very good. I agree. They have to attack soon. They can't maintain a siege due to the cost. And there's also the threat of reinforcements from a variety of directions. The Squids could come back. Earth could deploy more legions. Or the Empire itself might send forces.
The Empire? I asked, encouraged. Do you think that could happen?
It's unlikely, but possible.
What I don't understand is what the Saurians were thinking by coming here at all, I said.
Are you talking about their motivations?
No, sir, those are clear to me.
They're obviously here to maintain their local monopoly on heavy metals, preventing us from gaining a new internal supply. What I don't understand is why they think they can get away with it.
Drusus nodded. You believe our claim is more legitimate than theirs?
Yes, we're the enforcers of Frontier 921. We're fighting a legitimate war against an aggressor species.
Drusus pointed a finger at me. That's where you're wrong. We're outside the borders of the Empire right now. What happens out here isn't subject to galactic prohibitions other than directly attacking their assets, such as that Nerb ship you blew up.
I scratched myself through my thin suit and squinted at him.
You heard about that, did you?
How could I not have, but that's a topic for another conversation, McGill, should the Nerbs ever figure out that the cephalopods didn't do it.
So we reported to the Empire that the squids attacked the Nerb ship?
What choice did we have? You engineered the matter masterfully.
Klaver did that, really. I was just caught in the middle.
As always, Drusus said with more than a hint of sarcasm. That brings us back to the Saurians and their next move. Or should I say, Klaver's next move. I opened my mouth and my jaw just hung there for a time.
Are you saying Klaver brought the Saurian ships here?
Of course he did, Drusus said. Haven't you figured that out yet? Klaver's not done with Gamma Pavonis. He won't stop until either he's permed or we are.
I thought about that as Drusus continued to go over his strategies with me. I'd had the opportunity to perm Klaver back on board the Nerb ship. Maybe I should have permed Klaver instead of perming that Solstice Legionnaire Randy, who enjoyed torturing people. In comparison to Klaver, the sadist had been small potatoes. Chapter 46. The Saurian assault began 3 days later. They started off by withdrawing and hunkering down at the foot of the mountain. The alien troops that were posted above our elevation retreated to the snowy heights. Knowing these signs couldn't be good, we took shelter ourselves, keeping well back from the entrance but for a small contingent of troops on lookout duty. It just so happened that Winslade ordered me and my squad to stand duty at the entrance. To add insult to injury, he ordered us to do it without our dragons. "But sir," I argued when I received the orders from Leeson, "what good is a cavalry unit without our mounts?"
"You ask yourself that the next time you go off somewhere to play God, McGill," he shouted back.
He was red-faced and pissed off, and I had trouble blaming him.
"Are you suggesting, sir, that—"
I began.
"Shut up, McGill. Just shut the hell up. My platoon has been ordered to stand out here in our underwear with beamers in our hands due to your constant meddling. I swear if I survive this day, I'm going to remember this, veteran. Graves shouldn't have judged you the winner of that contest back on Green Deck. That's what I know for sure now."
With a sigh, I retreated. Leeson wasn't a bad officer, but he was as emotional as Graves was stern and unflappable. I knew he'd cool off later on. Probably. Going over the chain of command, it made sense to me that Winslade had given the grim orders. Turov might have done it, but she had retreated from the system, safe in her two ships. Tribune Drusus was aware of my extracurricular activities, but hadn't seemed overly upset by them. In fact, he'd given me a modicum of faint praise for my part in discovering various squid artifacts in the mines. No, it had to be Winslade. Of the group, he'd been the one most in favor of perming me the moment the Nerbs had shown up. Maybe this was his way of getting the job done. Better late than never, I guess. Harris greeted me next with a personal visit, and he wasn't any more pleasant than Leeson had been. Possibly he was even more hostile. His big finger jabbed me in the chest. As I wasn't wearing anything thicker than smart cloth, that finger sunk in and grated on my sternum.
"You asshole," he said. "You just can't hold your shit together, can you? I was a fool, a card-carrying fool to think you'd grown up."
"To what do I owe this assault, Harris?"
"You just had to go down into some tunnel and tease some alien until it bit someone. That's what I'm talking about. Winslade explained it to me. At least he explained enough. Winslade's an ass, but you're worse. If you didn't have rank,
I'd make you do push-ups until you puked. Then I'd let you lie in it while we all die here in this hole.
In an attempt to change the subject, I pointed downslope toward the enemy positions.
They're pulling back, sir. Not advancing. And why the hell would they do that? Because they're going to bombard us, that's why. Maybe they'll use some of that acidic gas that eats your suit. That should make your team extra happy you managed to get our commander to post us out here.
He stalked away, and I let him go without further comment. After all, he was right. Winslade was leaning on my team, and since Harris and Leeson were part of the same team, they were sharing in the pain. I had to wonder at Harris's mentioning of the discoveries from deep in the mountain. He must have heard about them from somewhere, and that they were the source of Winslade's displeasure. The discoveries themselves were neutral, so Winslade's anger had to be a result of the way I'd handled the situation, rather than the fact I'd done something on my own. It didn't take long for my slow brain to figure it out. What did Winslade like to do when a discovery was made? Why, he took all the credit personally, that's what. Apparently he wasn't punishing my people for the Nairb ship disaster. He was unhappy about me stepping over his head and going directly to Drusus, cutting him out of the loop. As there was nothing I could do about my orders, I stood my post with the rest of them. Everyone was glum, and few of them would meet my eye directly. For about an hour, we watched the skies and the slopes nervously. We moved around in a crouch when we moved at all, wary of snipers and enemy buzzers that were weaponized to kill. When the attack finally did come, it didn't go down the way I'd expected. There was no storm of missiles or massive bombardment from below. Instead, the attack came from above. I happened to be looking up, which everyone was doing a lot of, and I saw the gray skies suddenly lighten. A bluish ball fell from the heavens. It was like a ball of lightning, like a falling star of legend. I'd seen this phenomenon before, but from the standpoint of the man firing the weapon. I'd watched it play out from the tactical control room of Minotaur as her broadsides were fired on a planet, causing vast destruction. The others around me all began to run, but I didn't bother. I didn't crouch or throw myself flat. I stood tall, looming over all those who scrambled past me to get into the mouth of the tunnel in my back. As that single shell punched through the various layers of the atmosphere, it caused frozen rings of bluish light to encircle it. They expanded on their own like glowing ripples. It was a thing of beauty in its own deadly way. I knew there was no time left to run, nowhere to hide. A man might as well face death bravely and make the best of it. The single fusion shell arced down directly toward my position. One of those seven ships above us had coughed out a single shot, and every square kilometer on this vast planet, the exact spot I stood upon, had been selected for erasure. I had to wonder if Claver was up there, cackling with glee as the warhead fell. Maybe he'd pinpointed me on a vid report from a Saurian tech, or maybe he'd just gotten lucky. In any case, one second I stood proud and tall, and the next I was just a few atoms of vapor, drifting around the mountainside with the rest of them. When I awoke, I was surrounded by more than the usual degree of chaos.
"Get him off the table, stat!"
shouted a bio. I was rudely lifted and heaved onto the floor. I squirmed there painfully, my nerve endings still knitting up and reporting to my brain in a disorganized fashion.
"I'm not sure about the reading specialist,"
said an orderly who was running instruments over my legs. "I'm getting skeletal abnormalities. He might be a bad grow." This sent a chill through me. Abnormalities? A bad grow? How long was this version of James McGill going to grace Machine World with his presence? Through sheer effort of will, I struggled to my knees, then my feet. I wanted to cough. I wanted to pitch face forward onto the slimy floor. But I didn't. I stood, swaying, and the half of my mouth that was obeying me twisted upward in a grim parody of a confident smile. "I'm right as rain, orderly," I said. "Get off me. I've got to get back to my unit." The biospecialist was one I didn't know. She ran her eyes up and down my person like an auctioneer pricing horse flesh.
"He'll do. Give him a uniform and get him out of here,"
she said to the orderly. Shaking his head, the orderly helped me to a pile of loose clothing and discarded weapons. I took the biggest suit they had on hand, rammed the helmet down over my face, and gripped a beamer in both hands. I noticed as I was doing so, I was limping a little. The orderly kept looking at my bad leg. I took a deep breath and shook my head.
"It's just a Charlie horse," I said. "I get one every week."
"No," he said quietly, shaking his head. "You've got a torsion in your left femur. Your leg is twisted, and it's going to stay that way. Walking will be difficult, and running will be almost impossible." I frowned, thinking about that.
"I'm cavalry," I said. "I'll get in my dragon to make do."
The orderly shrugged and let go of my elbow. I swayed, but remained standing. I walked toward the exit, my left leg moving with my toes pointed inward. I adjusted and found I could totter along at a reasonable pace. But run? No way. That was bad. A worse error than I'd ever been born with before. Still, I found I didn't want to give up on my current existence. I briefly considered putting my beamer up against my throat and pulling the trigger, forcing them to recycle me, but I couldn't do it. From the sounds of battle outside the revival center, who knew if I'd ever draw breath again? It would be one thing to die proudly in battle, getting permed by the enemy because there was no one to bring me back to life. But to kill myself and then sleep forever, I couldn't do that. In the passageway outside, the chaos intensified. Troops were rushing this way and that. There were injured infantry everywhere, sitting with their backs up against the rough tunnel walls. Bio people knelt beside each in turn and sprayed them with portable flesh printers to reconstruct what they could. I knew right away things were bad. The bios were patching people up enough so they could stand and get back into the fight. That meant they couldn't afford to recycle and revive. They needed every trooper on the line they could get. Leeson was along one wall. He was being sprayed along a bare arm that was a bloody mess. The pink of new skin glared against his hairy shoulders, and he glared at me in recognition when I came close.
"McGill, you injured again already?"
He indicated my leg, and I nodded grimly.
"It's nothing, sir," I said. "Do I have a dragon waiting for me somewhere?"
"No,"
he said regretfully.
"We lost our mounts in the first counterattack. I didn't see you then. Is this your first time back on the front line?"
Front line, I thought to myself. Since when was the core of the mountain, the inner sanctum where we kept our most holy of tech devices, the revival machines, the front line?
"I'm a little out of touch, sir," I admitted.
"All right, get me on my feet and I'll fill you in on the way back to the fight. No, no, dummy. Lift me by my good arm."
I heaved him up with his less injured arm and looked him over. He didn't look like he was in much better shape than I was, but we both had beamers, and we were in the game. Working our way down long, echoing passages, we passed hundreds of troops gripping their snap rifles with eyes that rarely blinked. Most of them were Varus light troopers.
"We haven't got dragons," Leeson said, "but I know where there's a stash of heavy armor we can borrow."
I didn't argue with him. I didn't say much at all, in fact. He explained that after the Saurians used a single fusion shell to blow up the mouth of the mines, they'd exposed a number of inner chambers and galleries.
"It was like an anthill was cut away to reveal the panicked inhabitants," he said. "The initial blast killed 1,000 or so of us. Radiation cave-ins and follow-up conventional bombardment finished another cohort. But the enemy infantry waited until the next morning to assault on foot, probably to let the radiation levels die down a little."
"Is there any sign of reinforcements, sir?" I asked.
"None. Not from space or anywhere else, but the Saurians haven't had an easy time of it, I'll tell you that. We hung back that first day, squatting in the dark until a few thousand of them filtered into the rubble. Then we hit them hard. Booby traps, dragons, charging in close quarters. The enemy was armored, but we pushed them right back out. They don't seem to have any juggers with them, just the smaller raptor troops. They left at least 3,000 dead, and in the meantime, we've been churning out fresh troops with the revival machines."
That had always been one of our key advantages in battle. A human legion could face a force double or triple its size if it had the time to recycle her troops. If each man died 3 times, 10,000 legionnaires could do the fighting of 30,000. It rarely turned out that way in practice, however. Once a force reached the breaking point, it was overwhelmed and wiped out. The revival machines themselves could be destroyed as well by deep raids. So far, Varys had held on. But if I had to guess, from the look of the people in the tunnels, we were already down to half strength in men, materials, and spirit.
"There have been 2 more assaults since then," Leeson said. "We've tossed them all back out. I don't think the Saurians have revival machines either. Too expensive. They just keep throwing fresh troops at us, and they've got plenty of those."
I scowled. 3 assaults? How long had I been in limbo?
"How long has it been, sir, since they first smashed open the front entrance?"
"I don't know, about 40 hours, I guess. They're about to hit us again. Here, these are the heavy suits. Get in one. The exoskeleton will help with that bad leg."
He'd noticed my leg, and I winced at that. When a man came back fresh from a revive with a noticeable physical flaw, he knew he had to hide it. Under normal circumstances, Leeson was well within his rights to order me recycled. He didn't have to put up with a crippled man when he could have a fresh grow a few hours later. But Leeson never even suggested it. A limping McGill was better than nothing. The revival machines had to be used to churn out every soldier they could and get them back on the line. I wondered how many soldiers were hobbling their way to their next fight like I was. When I found a suit of armor that would fit me, I climbed into it and strapped my beamer to my arm. It felt good to be encased in metal again. I checked the systems and found the suit was fully charged and equipped with shields. I smiled at that.
"As soon as you see the flash of enemy fire, switch on your shielding," Leeson ordered, as if he'd read my mind.
"Can we gather any more of our people, sir?" I asked. "This seems a little disorganized."
"We'll join our unit at their designated post soon enough. Graves has been charged with holding the entrance to the lower tunnels. It's feared that the enemy will find a second entrance down there and flank us."
I nodded thoughtfully and followed him down spiraling dark passages into the depths of the mountain. Above us, distant explosions rumbled. The walls puffed with dust and showered pebbles onto our helmets and shoulder epaulettes. We met up with Graves and my old unit about 7 levels down. The sounds of fighting above were distant. Only about a third of Graves's team was still riding a dragon. The rest had lost their mounts and were dressed in light armor. The only men in heavy armor were Leeson and I. Envious eyes crawled over our equipment.
"Where'd you 2 steal that?" Graves asked.
"Orders were to make do with whatever we could find, sir," Leeson said.
"Yeah, fine. But turn off your nameplate, Leeson. It says you're Specialist Jane Kinlan."
"Sorry, sir,"
Leeson said, hastily turning off the letters which were emblazoned on his chest. I'd already removed my insignia, but I couldn't help but smile at Leeson's distress. He was a relatively small man, and whoever Jane was, her armor fit him like a glove. A few of the troops laughed. Our brief moment of levity was cut short when a warning came down from the upper tunnels. Saurian troops were approaching.
"If they're coming down here," Graves told us, "they must be seeking a way to flank us, a new route through the tunnels. We can't let them come up behind our lines. We'll stop them right here, or we'll die trying."
There was a muttered chorus of yes-sirs, but it wasn't enthusiastic. We hunkered down in the dark, turning on all our suit lights to the barest glimmer and watching on our night vision. No one talked about the enemy configuration or their numbers. Details like that didn't matter. We were to ambush them and hold our position to the last man. No one spoke as we all listened in the dark. The tramp of heavily armored alien feet could be heard echoing down the frosty tunnels toward our position. I gripped my rifle, and I waited in the dark. The only sounds were the hissing of oxygen from my tanks and the pounding of my heart.
Chapter 47. Right from the beginning, the fight was intense. The 2 sides met in the darkness, and the ripping sound of gunfire rang through the tunnel walls. We ambushed them, and they used explosives to destroy our strong points. Then we fell back to our next offensive line and repeated the process. Each time, both sides left their dead in the grit. The smoke was so thick I'd have been choking if I hadn't been wearing an airtight suit. At one point, they rushed us. They sought to close with an elusive enemy that had been tormenting them. Leeson was dead. I'd been cut off from the rest of the unit, and we were down to 6 effectives. As the veteran in the group, all their eyes looked at me for direction. "Stand your ground," I ordered my team, remembering how Graves had handled a similar situation underground facing this same enemy back on Steel World. He hadn't panicked, not even when it was clear we were about to be overwhelmed. I powered up my shield, and it formed a glimmering shell of force around me. My batteries were low, but saving power wasn't a good idea. It was use it or lose it time. I was the last trooper in heavy armor present, probably one of the last armored soldiers the Legion had. The least I could do was put on my best showing. My armor was getting pretty dinged up, but once my shield went on, smaller projectiles couldn't penetrate. Taking point, I shed bullets, fragments of explosives, and even the gravity-propelled pieces of grit from the tunnel floors like they were so many raindrops. When they got in close, I dropped my rifle, rose up, and extended my force blades. I'd set them to be thick and short as we were in close quarters. I didn't want to accidentally slash my own troops. The enemy Saurians came in a rush. But they weren't a disorganized mob. They were warriors, intelligent and capable. They fought with greater strength and ability than a man could possess. What they didn't have was shielding, or the knowledge they'd live again if they died on this rocky ground. A raptor engaged me, and all around us others broke up into small individual melees. We thrust and cut. His twin daggers were high-tech metal rather than energy, but they could still kill a man. One of his daggers struck home first, but my shielding deflected the blow. My return stroke with a power blade went in low and took off his right leg. He went down, but he didn't stop struggling. Inside his helmet I could see his teeth, his lashing tongue, and his black jewel-like eyes. We went into a clinch, and my exoskeleton screamed with the force of it. Before the fight, I'd turned down the juice to my arms to a minimum, so the power system could support both the force blades and the shielding. The drain on my cells was still high. I couldn't fight long at this level of power consumption. A buzzing sensation and a warning light showed the lizard was driving a blade into my belly, intent on gutting me. The weakness of any shield was a slow, steady attack. The thrust had gotten to the metal already, and the blade had begun to vibrate. That was the buzzing sound I'd heard. I finished him with a thrust of the throat, then straightened, sides heaving. 2 more Saurians showed up. Behind them, on the ground, lay Gorman. I hadn't even realized he was with my knot of troops. He'd been stationed with another group. He must have lost his position and been driven back to join me at my lonely outpost. He was dead, his guts spilled out all over the tunnel. A steady runnel of blood oozed out of his wrecked body and ran downhill behind me. The 2 Saurians had a plan, which they'd probably just worked upon Gorman to good effect. Each of them grabbed one of my arms and worked to drive a dagger into my guts. Seconds, that's all I had. The shielding gave way steadily. The armor of my chest plate was thick, but the points of the enemy blades were soon buzzing and penetrating. Had they studied us? Had they brought these knives just to defeat human legionnaires? The answer to these questions didn't matter, so I drove them from my mind. I was about to die. I took a chance. Using verbal commands, I ordered my suit to switch off my shielding and transfer all my power to my limbs. This had 2 startling effects. Both of the vibrating blades rasped against my armor, slipping due to the sudden lack of resistance. But my arms, at the same moment, became more powerful than any Saurian that had ever lived. I didn't have time for anything fancy. I slammed both the Saurian soldiers together like a bully knocking together 2 boys' heads. This had little effect as they were armored as well, but it did get those blades out of my gut for a moment, and it set the Saurians up for my next move. Slashing horizontally, I swept a force blade across both their necks. The blade was driven with such force that it beheaded both. They toppled at my feet, and I re-engaged my shields. More came after that. Around me, most of my team died. Hudson, Keevy, Sargon, they all fell. In the end, only Carlos and I
stayed on our feet. In the meantime, the attack had been repelled.
"I think," panted Carlos, "I think they ran out of lizards."
"Maybe," I said. "Let's go find out." Groaning, he followed my advance. We paused only to touch the tappers of the dead and to lift their power cells if they had more juice in them than ours did. We only ran into the lizards one more time, and they didn't want to engage. They were falling back, performing a fighting retreat. We didn't make it easy for them. We'd linked up with survivors from other squads and units. Graves himself had lived. Altogether, he led a force of 15-odd troopers, all that was left. We dogged the enemy all the way back to the smoke-filled central chambers. The lizards were falling back, still in good order, but their lines were getting ragged with losses.
"Concentrate fire," Graves ordered. "Aim for the legs to bring a target down, then go to the next. Don't pepper them all, they're already retreating. We need to make them pay by taking down every enemy combatant we can."
Coldly, we did as he ordered. It was a slaughter, shooting down fleeing Saurians. They threw back fire now and then, but it was only to keep us ducking. We kept advancing, relentlessly. It seemed to take an hour to reach the surface where we halted for fear they'd hit us with some kind of bombardment. A breathless cheer went up among the survivors as we viewed the aftermath of the battle. Thousands lay dead, and the enemy was in full retreat.
"That was close, sir," I said to Graves. He looked at me.
"Closer than you think. Most of our lines were broken. Your tunnel held, but it was a rare exception. Good job, McGill."
I frowned. "Sounds like they were winning, sir. Why'd they pull out right before they finished us?"
"I don't know. Maybe even an army of reptiles can have enough death to fill their bellies with fear."
That didn't sound like the Saurian troops I'd met. They tended to fight to the death unless ordered to retreat by their masters. Daring to advance further, I walked out upon the slopes themselves. Graves stayed in the shadowy tunnels behind me.
"You can dream about your death wish if you want, McGill," he called. "But you'll do it on your own time. I forbid you to run out there into the open and lose a perfectly good suit of armor."
"Thanks for your concern, Centurion," I told him. "But you should really come up here and see this for yourself." Finally, he advanced and hunkered down beside me. Above us, an overhang of cracked rock projected. From the shadows underneath, we could see the mountainside. It ran down about 2 kilometers to the roiling edge of the thick white mists that covered most of the planet. Just before the edge of the mist, a battle was in progress.
"What the... are those machines?"
Graves asked. "Yes, sir, I think they are."
"What are they doing?"
"Eating Saurians, sir. By the hundreds. Or at least they're eating their weapons, armor, and equipment. They must be hungry." Graves looked at me, squinting.
"Did you expect this?"
"Me, sir, how could I know?"
"The message you sent, using the young machine creature. Natasha translated it, didn't she tell you?"
"There hasn't been much time, sir," I said. "I was revived and thrown straight into the fight." He nodded.
"Natasha and Kiwi worked on the translation for hours. They figured out it was pretty much a dinner bell, a summons to a feast. They thought it might be the message the squids used to get the machines to come here and chew on the mountain, exposing titanium veins."
I blinked at him. I had no idea. But it makes sense. Carlos was eaten for a reason, after all. He must have accidentally promised that baby machine a dinner, and the machine figured he must have meant to eat his suit. Graves laughed then. It was a rare sound, an unpleasant chuckle.
"Best thing Ortiz ever did. The baby machine took his message off to the nearest herd of native machines, and dinner time."
Graves laughed some more. I grinned as well. We watched the chaos below for several more minutes before retreating. The Saurians had been hit from behind by a hungry mob of machines. The only source of easy metal had been on the Saurians themselves, who were new to this odd planet. Flanked by surprise, they'd called a retreat from our tunnels to deal with this new threat. As far as I was concerned,
It couldn't have happened to a nicer bunch of lizards.
Chapter 48. Getting slammed in the flank was too much for the Saurian forces, or at least for their commanders. They'd been losing too much strength against us all along, but they'd been buoyed up by the certain knowledge they were driving us back, winning through attrition. By the time I reached the core of our stronghold, seeking repairs for my equipment and sustenance for my body, Leeson had been revived. He met me and shook my gauntlet.
"Well done, McGill. You held the line."
"Thank you, Adjunct."
"Even better, they're still retreating," Leeson said. "Have you seen the vids coming down from the buzzers?"
"No, sir, I haven't had—"
"By damn, I still don't believe it. Those cowardly lizards are tucking their collective scaly tails and running for their lives."
I echoed his excitement and relief, but I didn't think they were cowardly. Saurians were anything but. I'd once watched one self-execute without a qualm, just because an irritated Nairb had told him to do so.
"I think their commanders are losing heart. Not the troops," I said.
"What? Have you fallen in love with another alien race, McGill? How typical. Maybe you should run down this molehill after them and beg them to come back for tea."
"Hardly, sir. I was just pointing out that Saurians are very brave as individuals."
"Why the hell are they running, then?"
"To my way of thinking, they've just realized this entire battle is becoming too costly. They've probably spent all their funding on renting ships and arms, not on revival machines. Those choices resulted in a much more powerful force, but a brittle one. They couldn't absorb endless losses. They're probably retreating now because they've lost half their troops. I don't think they planned on that."
"Hmm," Leeson said. "You think their morale didn't break, but the bank did?"
"Interesting. I have to admit their princes are more money-conscious than they are humanitarians."
"Well, either way, we're all as good as dead now."
This statement concerned me. Leeson still seemed happy, but I could see a hint of resignation there as well.
"We're dead?" I asked. "Why is that, sir?"
He looked at me in triumph, squinting his small eyes.
"Ha! Don't tell me you didn't reason out their next move, Mr. Strategist."
I frowned at him. Leeson had a naturally abrasive attitude, but he wasn't dumb. I honestly wanted to know what he was thinking, despite his barbs.
"You tell me, Adjunct," I said.
Leeson showed me the unit's tactical display. He ran his finger down the slope toward the massing Saurian troops at the base of the mountain. They'd managed to repel the hungry machines, but only after devastating losses. They hadn't been prepared for such an enemy and lacked the heavy weaponry to deal with them. To kill the big machines, groups of soldiers were rushing in close and essentially committing suicide to stop them. I'd seen Centurion Belter employ similar tactics to good effect, but we could revive our losses. They couldn't.
"Think about it," Leeson said. "They're beating the machines, but preparing to pull out anyway. Why leave the mountain entirely? They could just siege us from down there. But instead, they're setting up to have transports come down and pick up their battered troops."
"Maybe they want to get out of this hellhole, sir. At least that's what I think they're doing."
"Nah, they'll pull up stakes all right, but they won't give up. They'll unleash their big guns again, all of them this time. Sure, that will destroy most of this mountain and the titanium mine, but the raw ore will survive. 100 or so fusion shells, that's what I expect will come falling our way once these lizards lift off. You see if they don't."
I was alarmed by his prediction. For one thing, it made sense. For another, there was no way anyone in Legion Varus, cavalry or otherwise, could survive such a devastating attack.
"That means we can't let them get back into space," I said. "We've got to stop them."
Leeson shook his head and cracked his faceplate open long enough to spit.
"You let me know when you've figured out how to do that, McGill."
He laughed bitterly. Turning away, I began to trot back down the tunnels into the mountain. My pace turned into a thundering run by the time I reached Drusus's office. I'd adjusted my suit to power my legs, so I didn't have to limp. There were several techs in the Tribune's chamber with him. They were rolling up computer scrolls, and they moved with an air of purpose. They weren't panicked yet, but they were sure in a hurry. "Tribune," I asked. He looked up at me, but didn't smile. In fact, his face scrunched up a bit, like he smelled something unpleasant.
"What fresh disaster brings you here, veteran?"
he asked me. "Can I talk to you for a second?"
"No time, we're pulling out. Most of the troops won't make it. I'll have your people go down deep in the mines, to the very bottom if necessary. Maybe a few will survive."
I watched for a moment as he stuffed a computer scroll into a capsule, then another. Tribune Drusus spoke to the techs he was working with. I noted with surprise that one of them was Natasha.
"Send out one of these with every flying drone we've got," he ordered. "Send them in every direction."
"Already programmed, sir," Natasha said.
"Good. Fly those birds."
Natasha rushed out with a capsule under her arm and a worried look on her face. Everyone looked like they were about to die, probably because they were.
"Natasha," I said, catching up to her, "what's the plan?"
"Plan?" she asked. "That's a big word for this desperate attempt to survive. We're sending out drones in every direction. They'll fly until they run out of fuel, then crash into the snow and wait. If they hear a friendly signal later on, they'll start chirping, hoping to be found."
"Okay, what's in the capsules?"
"Data. Lists of the soon-to-be-dead. Your name, your DNA, and mental backups. Mine, too. If someone comes looking and finds them, well, maybe they'll revive us out of the goodness of their hearts."
"I thought Turov took our DNA prints with her when she pulled out."
"Yes, if she made it back to Earth. But there has to be confirmation to get a legal revival. They won't just make a full copy of our Legion back on Earth without sending out a mission to confirm our status. These documents will prove we should be revived."
Watching in concern, I frowned at her while she worked. I almost mentioned that she could end up a triplet, but I was smart enough not to say that.
"But are you sure that we'll all die?" I asked. "Drusus said that he was sending the troops deep into the mines." "It won't matter. Nothing will survive a steady bombardment by the broadsides. We've done the math. They've got 7 capital ships up there, James. Grow up. We're all as good as permed. Whether we get buried in the tunnels or vaporized out on the surface."
She moved as if to push past me, but I held on to her arm, and she looked up at me reluctantly.
"Look," I said. "We can't let the lizards fire their cannons."
"How are we going to stop them?"
"You've got to help me," I said. "You've got to get me in touch with Claver."
"Oh, no, forget that," she said, shaking her head.
She headed up the tunnels, and I followed. We reached the upper chambers and then the exposed, smoldering galleries. The mess outside was dramatic, and most of it was obscured by fog and smoke. She set up and released her drone loaded with data scrolls. It looked like a messenger pigeon, but it buzzed rather than flapped. We watched as it darted into the smoke, then appeared again. Suddenly, a beam lanced out from downslope and took the drone out. It fell in burning pieces, which steamed in the snow. Natasha made a sound of anguish.
"It's hopeless."
"Come on, girl, give my plan a shot," I said. She looked at me for a second, then shook her head.
"I don't even know what your plan is, and I don't want to know. I'm following my orders this time, James. I'm sending out these drones. It's our best hope."
She knelt and began working on another drone. This time she programmed it to climb up high, hoping to get out of the range of the enemy automated turrets. I didn't think it would work, but she wasn't going to stop trying.
"Look, I'll do that," I said, taking the handheld terminal from her. "Just get your comm equipment out and set it up."
Heaving a sigh, she did as I asked.
"You never give up on anything, do you?"
she asked.
"No, I guess not."
She got out our tech specialist computer and put it down in the snow. A small dish extended from the core brick. But then she stopped.
"No," she said. "I'm not going to do this. I'm going to follow my orders, and that's all. Why die violating my Tribune's final wishes? You've always got me into trouble, James. I see that now. I'll never understand why I listen to you."
This little speech of hers made me angry and desperate at the same time. My mind raced, trying to come up with something I could use to influence her. I had the answer in less than a second, but I didn't want to use it. Only the fact that the Legion was facing a wipe, possibly a permanent one, caused me to say what I said next. "Natasha," I said,
You haven't always followed the rules, you know. You've come up with some violations all your own. Remember back on Dust World, when you committed a stack of high crimes?
What? I did no such thing, not without your urging. It was you who shot a neutral airship and started this war with the squids. That's what I remember.
Yeah, but before that, you didn't want to die on Corvus, remember?
She looked at me with sudden concern.
You said you wouldn't talk about that.
I'm just trying to make a point. You reached a situation that made you desperate, and you took your chances. In fact, you and your fellow mutineers took over Corvus and escaped into orbit around the local star.
Natasha froze. She turned to face me, her cheeks red.
I didn't do that. I told you I planned to do it, that maybe there was a twin of me somewhere out—
No, I said, my voice becoming gentle. I took her hands in mine, and I looked her in the eyes.
You didn't try to do it. You did it. Della told me.
She knows you very well. That's the reason she avoids you. She knows your twin, and everyone on Dust World is grateful to her.
I don't think I've ever seen such an odd look on a human face before. It was full of surprise, fear, horror, and wonder, all at once.
Della told you this?
She asked in a small voice.
She knows. Why didn't you say something?
How do you feel right now?
Sick.
That's why I kept it quiet, I said. I'm only telling you now because we're facing that kind of situation. We're here, you and I and thousands of others. I don't want to pretend this body doesn't matter. I don't have a copy out there on Dust World who will carry on in my stead. Even if I'm brought back to life someday, that's not good enough. I want this version of me to live, just like you did back aboard Corvus.
Are you shitting me, James? Because if you are, I'm never going to forgive you.
I shook my head. While she was thinking it over, I programmed and released the drone. It flew off with a buzzing sound and vanished into the smoke and haze. A moment later, it was shot down as well.
I'm telling you the plain truth, Natasha. I've been carrying this secret with me for weeks now. I didn't want to tell you, because I knew it would freak you out. I apologize for telling you now.
Here,
she said, handing me a headset. I looked at it. And then at her. Her eyes were avoiding mine. I gave her a hug and a kiss on the top of the head.
Just hurry up,
she said.
Whatever madness you've got in mind, I want you to do it and get it over with, now.
Oddly enough, it wasn't that hard to get a hold of Claver. I knew his private channel, and it appeared that no one else was trying to reach him right now.
Who's this? He demanded. Get off the line if this isn't official business.
It's official, all right, I said. I want to negotiate a surrender.
Is this McGill? Ha ha. No dice, moron. First off, you aren't in charge of Jack's squat. Secondly, you're gonna die today. That's what every lizard wants to see, and that's what we're going to give them with these rented ships. I'm going to operate the broadsides myself. I'm their gunner, did you know that? I dropped that first one on your head, and I'm going to enjoy unloading all 16 the next time.
Sir, I said, I'm not going to appeal to your humanity, just to your greed.
Claver paused. How's that?
He asked, finally. I took a deep breath, closed my eyes, and made my pitch.
I've got access to something you want. Something you would do almost anything to get your hands on.
Claver was quiet for a few seconds.
The key. Are you telling me Turov left the galactic key in your country bumpkin manure-stained hands, boy? Because if that's your game, I'm not buying it. Turov is six kinds of a bitch, but she's not stupid. She'd never...
Sir, what I have is access to Turov, and she has the key.
If you let us get off this world without operating those big guns for the Saurians, I'll procure it and hand it over to you at a later date." There was another, longer silence. Down slope I could see the mists swirling. I knew the Saurians were still embattled with the machines at the foot of the mountain, out of sight. Occasionally an explosion ripped through the air, and flashes erupted in the vapors like lightning bursts inside a cloud.
"Why this? Why now?"
he demanded, sounding greedy but suspicious.
"Why not just take your lumps and catch a revive back home?"
"Because Turov might not come back. She might scratch this legion from her roster forever. Think of all the baggage she'd relieve herself of if she left us dead and gone."
"Let's say I buy your bullshit. Let's pretend I believe you can get the key, and that you aren't just blowing smoke up my butt in general. Why would you hand it over when you have possession? You might forget about a deal with gullible old Claver at that point."
"I gave the key up before, to Turov. That was a mistake. She hasn't bettered Earth's cause with it. She's used it for personal gain."
"And you think I'm some kind of philanthropist?"
"I'm not under any illusions in that regard, sir, but I think you're trying to build a trading empire while I think Turov is trying to rise to the top of Earth's military. I find you dangerous, but less so than she is."
"You're pulling at my heartstrings, boy. After all, I'm just an old-fashioned softy underneath, and I hate to see a fellow schemer suffer."
I rolled my eyes at his words, but I managed not to laugh.
"Out of the kindness of my inner being,"
he continued as if he was doing me a tremendous favor,
"I'm inclined to accept your terms. I'll do what I can, but I can't offer any promises. These Saurians don't want to operate the big guns themselves because they're not licensed to do so, but I'm not under any such prescriptions. Without my help, they may or may not decide to break the rules and do it themselves. My guess is that they won't, but..."
"I'm willing to take the gamble," I said. "For one thing, it's all I've got. For another, I'm betting on Saurian respect for the law. They like to follow the rules strictly. They won't work the guns and violate the galactic statutes. What I don't get is how they had the balls to hire warships and fly out here in the first place."
"Haven't you figured that out yet, dummy? Earth people are enforcers now, leaving the role of provincial mercenaries open. We lost our monopoly on the mercenary service when we accepted the elevation in status. Now that the job is open on Frontier 921, the lizards are going for it all out. It's not just the medals they were after out here. They want to prove they can defeat an Earth Legion on the ground."
"Sucks to be them in that case, sir." He gave me a long, dirty chuckle that ended in a coughing fit.
"You boys pretty much kicked their tails in. I had trouble not enjoying the spectacle. But let's cut the crap. Do we have a deal?"
"Yes," I said. My heart was heavy in my chest.
"When do I take delivery of my prize?"
"You have to give me a year, sir. Shouldn't take any longer than that."
"A year? What the hell kind of..."
"You could speed that up," I suggested. "If you left us a deep link by accident, the plan's odds of success would be greatly enhanced. Otherwise, we've got no way to communicate with Earth. We'll have to wait for hegemony ships to scout the system again before we'd be able to get off this rock." Claver grumbled and cursed, but at last he agreed that it would speed up the process. Who knew if Turov would ever come back to see what happened on Gamma Pavonis? He couldn't take the risk that he'd let us live but not get home. I couldn't give him the galactic key if I didn't get back to Turov to take it. He closed the channel, and I looked up at the skies. Blue-white flares of plasma burned in the upper atmosphere. The Saurian lifters were coming down to pick up their troops. Hundreds of lifters for thousands of troops.
I rushed inside the caves to tell Tribune Drusus what I'd done. If he shot down the Saurian lifters, even one of them, the deal might fall apart.
Chapter 49. I'll be the first to admit my methods are unorthodox, that I frequently step on the toes of my superior officers. No, that's not right. I stomp on them. But when such actions result in miraculous improvements to the well-being of Legion Varus, one might think a little praise was in order. Instead, when I explained what I'd done, I was met with shocked silence. The silence was unfortunately brief and was immediately followed by a tirade of swearing. Tribune Drusus wasn't doing the swearing, however. A certain primus named Winslade was the one creating the stink.
"How dare you, McGill?" he asked, as if he couldn't quite catch his breath. "How dare you?"
"Well, sir," I said, "I happen to have a personal relationship with Claver, and I know how he thinks. I only appealed to his better nature and succeeded." All the officers in the chamber eyed me with a distinct air of mistrust. I found this almost insulting. After all, we were in this together. We were going to die on this rock without help.
"So?"
Drusus said, stepping forward and putting up a hand to stop Winslade's next outburst.
"You're saying you talked Claver into leaving without bombing us out of existence?"
"Yes, sir, exactly."
"Claver is a traitor, not a charity," Drusus said. "What was in it for him?"
"First off, he was their gunner," I said.
"We know that.
And without him, it's unlikely the Saurians will have enough scaly balls to bomb us."
"Fair enough," Drusus said. "But again, what was Claver's source of gain in this deal you arranged? He has to get something out of it."
My attempts to switch the subject had clearly failed. I looked from one of them to the next, blinking and thinking fast. They weren't going to buy any kind of compassion on the part of Adjunct Claver. I couldn't blame them for that. Anyone who'd met the man knew he'd sell his grandma for a bent credit piece and a cup of coffee.
"He wants trading rights," I said quickly.
"Not between Machine World and Earth, but between Machine World and the rest of Frontier 921. There were murmurs and growls at this. They believed it, but they weren't happy about it.
"That's not all," I said. "He wants every ingot in this mine stacked outside for picking up later. Once we've gotten a ship here to pull us out, we're to leave the titanium on the surface and not look back."
There was even more louder grumbling at that. But eventually they settled down and accepted the terms. What choice did they have, really? Who would risk being permed to stop a trade deal? Not these people, and not me, either. The following hours were tense as we waited for the Saurians to withdraw and leave in their ships. They took to the air, vanishing into the sky in their lifters. I was jealous to see it. I'd never watched aliens with such envy. When they were all hanging up there over our heads, it was hard not to walk in a crouch down here on the surface. Drusus ordered us below, and most followed those orders, but not me. I wandered the rubble-filled tunnels, wondering if I was enjoying the final moments of existence that would ever be allotted to me. Drusus himself hailed me in the upper galleries. He walked up and stared at me.
"Defiant to the last, McGill?" he asked. I shrugged.
"Sorry, sir," I said. "But I figured if a man's going to be blasted to atoms, he might as well walk under an open sky under his own power."
"I can see you're still limping now that you're out of your armor,"
he said, looking me over.
"We can fix that, you know."
"A regrow? What's the point? I'll be dead or alive in a few hours' time, and either way I won't care about my leg."
"Suit yourself."
He was quiet for a second, and we both studied the skies. Finally, he had to ask what was on everyone's mind.
"Do you think they'll really let us go, James? You talk to Claver, not me. Can we trust him?"
"Not at all, sir. Not for a dime, a dollar, or a two-penny candy, as my grandfather used to say. But we can reason through what he wants. And if he wants something we can give, he'll stick to an agreement. He couldn't be successful as a trader otherwise."
I guess not, he said, and sighed. It's galling to have to depend on an enemy, too. Just then my tapper beeped. I glanced down at it, frowning. No one should have been able to reach me here, standing in the wreckage and blasted craters of the mine's upper chambers. I glanced at Tribune Druses, who nodded with curiosity.